Welcome to this 11KBW podcast on secreting the evidence, investigation, privilege, and pre-termination negotiations by Patrick Halliday. This talk was given at the 11KBW Employment Law Conference on the 14th of May 2018 at the Rosewood Hotel in London. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
Yeah, I was actually given the title for my talk and asked to speak on it, and when I first read it, I did wonder what was meant by secreting the evidence. Secreting sounded to me more like a topic for a biology lecture than a legal talk, but you'll be as relieved as I was to hear that actually I'm going to be talking about keeping evidence secret, not about its bodily discharge, and about the law of privilege. In particular, I think there have been three interesting developments in the law of privilege over the last 18 months or so. The first of those is concerning the issue which Chris foreshadowed a moment ago, and that's the question of whether or not interviews by lawyers of employees during an internal investigation should remain privileged. The second topic concerns litigation privilege. It's the issue of whether documents created for regulators' investigations should be covered by litigation privilege. And thirdly, I want to talk about the breadth of the iniquity exception by which legal advice privilege may be disapplied, and in particular, whether a lawyer's advice on A, how to commit an unlawful team move, or B, how to commit unlawful discrimination or victimisation should fall within the iniquity principle such that privilege is disapplied. Before diving into those developments, I think it's always useful to anchor ourselves in the basics. And it's worth reminding ourselves of the three categories of privilege which are most important for employment lawyers. So there are two types of legal professional privilege. There's legal advice privilege and litigation privilege. And then there's without prejudice privilege, which covers negotiations between opposing parties who are trying to settle a dispute. I've tried to squeeze onto a single slide a comprehensive but exhaustive definition of each of the requirements of each of those categories. Legal advice privilege applies only if the following four conditions are satisfied. First, it covers the contents of communications. Secondly, the communication must be between a client and the client's lawyer. Thirdly, it must be made in confidence. And fourthly, it must have been made for the purposes of giving or receiving legal advice. So purely business advice won't be privileged, even if it's given by a lawyer, if that lawyer isn't effectively wearing a lawyer's hat. I should add that secondary evidence of such communications is also covered. It's also privileged insofar as it reproduces or reveals the contents of a privileged communication. So, for example, if two employees of a client exchange emails in which they summarise legal advice that the company has received, those emails will themselves be privileged. Even though they're not themselves a lawyer-client communication, they reproduce or reveal the contents of the legal advice, which is a lawyer-client communication. Moving on to litigation privilege, where the other conditions are satisfied, that applies to any communication between a client and a lawyer, or between the client and a third party, or between a lawyer and a third party. So in that sense, it's considerably wider than legal advice privilege, which is limited to lawyer-client communications. But it's narrower in a different sense, namely it applies only where adversarial litigation either has commenced or is reasonably in prospect. And finally, it applies only where the sole or dominant purpose of the communication is obtaining legal advice or otherwise preparing for adversarial litigation, typically where a party is gathering evidence for that litigation. And finally, on the slide, without prejudice, privilege applies to any communications between opposing parties, which are made for the purposes of a genuine attempt to compromise a dispute between them. That's subject to various exceptions. The most well-known and significant of those is the unambiguous impropriety exception. See, for example, the Metsotera case in the EAT from about 2010. I'm going to talk first about recent developments in legal advice privilege, and then about recent developments in the law of litigation privilege. There are some slides at the back of the pack on without prejudice privilege, but I'm not actually going to talk about that because, so far as I'm aware at least, there haven't been any significant developments in that area in the last year or so. So still by way of context, a couple of older cases which are very important still. The two most important decisions on legal advice privilege both arose out of the Three Rivers litigation in the mid-2000s. The creditors of the bank, BCCI, unsuccessfully sued the Bank of England for misfeasance in public office on the basis of the bank's alleged failure to supervise BCCI properly. Lord Justice Bingham held an inquiry into BCCI's collapse, and the bank set up a Bingham Investigation Unit, the BIU, and all of the bank's communications with its external lawyers, Freshfields, were channeled through the BIU. The BIU communicated directly with Freshfields, who also provided the BIU with advice. And during the litigation, the first key decision on privilege was the Court of Appeals decision in Three Rivers No. 5. And that was a restrictive and controversial decision. The Court of Appeal held that legal advice privilege could be claimed only in respect of communications between the BIU and Freshfields, even if the purpose of internal communications between other employees was to enable Freshfields to be instructed. So preparatory documents which were produced by other employees didn't fall within the scope of the privilege. And over the next decade or so, there was considerable debate amongst practitioners and textbook writers as to whether the outcome in Three Rivers No. 5 was, on the one hand, one which depended on the particular facts in that case. In particular, there was an unusual situation where a particular body within the corporation had been set up to act as the client, namely the BIU, or on the other hand, whether it was a decision of broader application, an authority for a proposition that communications between a company's employees and its lawyers are not generally privileged. But in any event, what it undoubtedly decided is that legal advice privilege can only apply to communications between client and lawyer. So if employee-lawyer communications are to be covered, that employee has to be the client. By contrast, the House of Lords decision in Three Rivers No. 6, the second bullet on the slide, concerned a different aspect of legal advice privilege, namely the question of what counts as legal advice, the fourth requirement on the previous slide. And on this aspect, the House of Lords adopted an expansive view of privilege. It held that legal advice privilege applied to Freshfield's presentational advice as to how to present factual material before the inquiry in an orderly and attractive fashion. It didn't matter, said the House of Lords, that the advice did not relate strictly to advice on legal rights and obligations. And under the test set out by the House of Lords, legal advice extended to advice as to what should be prudently and sensibly done in a quote-unquote relevant legal context. Lord Scott put the test in terms of whether the lawyers were being asked to exercise their legal skills. So the Court of Appeals decision in Three Rivers No. 5 in particular set the stage for three recent decisions on legal advice privilege in the last 18 months. They are the Aztec Therapeutics case, the RBS rights issue case, and Serious Fraud Office and ENRC. The basic situation addressed in all three of those cases was the same. A company thinks it has a problem. It decides that its lawyers should investigate that problem and provide advice. The company authorizes its employees to speak to the lawyers, and the lawyers interview the employees. And the issue is this: are the records of those interviews, interviews between lawyers and employees, covered by legal advice privilege? And in all three cases, the courts ruled that the answer was no. The reason was that the employee interviews were not lawyer-client communications. The employees did not fall to be treated as the clients, and for the purposes of the law of privilege, the employees were acting as third parties, so-called. Since the interviews were therefore communications between lawyers and third parties, they weren't protected by legal advice privilege. It was argued in these cases that if a company authorises employees to speak to its lawyers, that means that the employees should be treated as the client, since they're providing factual instructions to the lawyers on the client's behalf. And the courts rejected that argument. It is, they ruled, not enough for the employee simply to have the company's permission to provide information to the lawyer. Where a company instructs lawyers, the only persons who are the client are those employees authorised to seek and receive legal advice on the corporation's behalf. So employees who are interviewed merely to elicit factual information are not to be treated as instructing the lawyers. And that's an important restriction. For many years, banks and solicitors' firms have been proceeding on the assumption that internal investigations conducted by lawyers are protected by the cloak of privilege. I think it's fair to say that firms in the city have done a lot of business under that assumption over the last decade, two decades. It's certainly an assumption which has been reached in good faith. The leading textbook on the law of privilege, Bank and Tanky QC's book, did express the view that if employees are authorised to provide factual information to investigating lawyers on behalf of the client, they should be treated as themselves, the client, providing instructions. But the courts have now categorically rejected that view in a series of decisions, which is unfortunately going to be a matter of regret to many people in this room, many firms of lawyers throughout the city. ENRC is now on appeal. It's due to be heard by the Court of Appeal sometime this year. My own view is that the Court of Appeal is likely to uphold Mrs. Justice Andrews' decision in ENRC. I think that decisions in all three of these cases were really unavoidable in the light of the Court of Appeal's reasoning in Three Rivers No. 5, properly construed. So if this aspect of the law is to be changed, and it may be, it's a change which will have to be introduced either by the Supreme Court overruling Three Rivers No. 5 or by Parliament. And for completeness, I should note that a further argument was raised in the RBS case. The claimants who were resisting privilege argued that where a company sought legal advice, the only persons who could be regarded as the client were those who individually or together constituted part of the directing mind and will of the corporation. And the concept of a directing mind, sometimes referred to as the theory of corporate attribution, is separate from the law of agency. It's more restrictive. Only those in control of a company, of the relevant part of its operations, count as the company's directing mind. And typically, that will be limited to the company's directors. So if only those who form the directing mind may be treated as the company itself when asking who the client is, this would be a significant further restriction on what communications are privileged. But in the end, Mr. Justice Hildyard, in the RBS case, didn't decide this issue. He'd already rejected the claim for privilege on the basis I've described. But he did give some succour to those who wanted to run such an argument. He said, "I suspect that such a restriction will often reflect reality. A corporation is unlikely to authorise the giving of legal advice on its behalf to an individual or a body which is not its directing mind and will. Further, in my view, there are good reasons for it not doing so and for the law not extending privilege if it does." But I must say that personally, I can't see why only those who are the directing mind of a company can be treated as the company itself when asking who is acting on behalf of the company as the client. To take an example from the employment law context, low-level managers are often authorised to take legal advice on how to deal with a particular employment situation. Low-level managers are highly unlikely to count as the company's directing mind. But I think it would be very surprising indeed if advice taken by a low-level manager from lawyers on an employment situation was not protected by privilege. So my own view is that as long as an individual employee is authorised to seek and receive legal advice on behalf of the company, that individual is properly to be treated as the client, even if he or she is not part of the company's directing mind. And for now, at least, there's no binding authority that directing mind is a further requirement. So moving on from legal advice privilege to litigation privilege, this was also considered in the ENRC case. And at this point, I should say a little more about the facts in ENRC. There was a whistleblower allegation of fraud, bribery, and corruption in foreign states. This resulted in discussions with the Serious Fraud Office under the self-reporting regime operated by the Serious Fraud Office. And the Serious Fraud Office commenced a criminal investigation. The SFO issued notices, statutory notices, compelling ENRC to produce various documents which ENRC had produced in its own internal investigations for the purposes of the SFO investigation. But ENRC resisted disclosure both on the basis of legal advice privilege, that basis being rejected for the reasons I gave before, but also on the basis of litigation privilege. Now, as I mentioned earlier, litigation privilege covers communications for the sole or dominant purpose of obtaining information or advice in connection with existing or reasonably contemplated adversarial litigation. And there are really three points of interest concerning litigation privilege which arose out of the ENRC decision. And the first of those was that the court considered whether litigation privilege extends to documents created in order to obtain legal advice as to how to avoid contemplated litigation. Information which is gathered to send to the other side to say, there's nothing to see here. Mrs. Justice Andrews held that it does not apply to such documents on the basis that it would be inconsistent with the underlying rationale for litigation privilege, which is to enable parties to prepare for litigation free from the risk of disclosure of such preparations. And she said that a party equipping itself with evidence that it hopes will dissuade a potential opponent from commencing proceedings is something entirely different than preparing for those proceedings and is therefore outside the scope of litigation privilege. Once proceedings are on foot, however, the judge ruled, documents produced in order to reach a settlement are within the scope of litigation privilege. I think that creates a difficult dividing line. It's questionable whether a sharp demarcation can be drawn between evidence and documents gathered for the purposes of early settlement and those gathered for potential substantive proceedings. In many cases, much the same material would be covered. A dual purpose for the documents could be advanced, and the court recognised the possibility that documents produced to assist in avoiding proceedings could have been prepared with the further purpose of assisting in the defence if proceedings were subsequently initiated. So the difficulty is that it then becomes necessary to show that the dominant purpose was to assist in the defence and not the avoidance of proceedings. An equal purpose is not enough. In ENRC, the evidence fell short of establishing this, and one imagines that it may well do so in many other cases. The second point of general application from ENRC is that a criminal investigation does not count as adversarial litigation for the purposes of litigation privilege. It's well established that litigation must be adversarial as opposed to investigative or inquisitorial in order for litigation privilege to apply. In the contents of SFO prosecutions, they are very often preceded by an SFO investigation. Nonetheless, the court ruled that the claim by ENRC that the context of an SFO investigation was enough for litigation privilege to bite was rejected by the court as misconceived. I think this aspect of the decision will have significant implications given the ubiquity of self-reporting and regulatory cooperation across many sectors. And there are clear parallels here with investigations by the Financial Conduct Authority. And the third and final point of general application is a related one, related to the second one. And that concerns the question of when there's a real likelihood of adversarial litigation. ENRC argued that if a criminal investigation were contemplated, then so too would a criminal prosecution be contemplated. And that is because SFO investigations are often a prelude to SFO prosecutions. But Mrs. Justice Andrews rejected that argument too. She refused to equate the SFO investigation with an SFO prosecution. Whether a criminal prosecution was likely following an investigation had to be considered, she said, on a case-by-case basis, looking at the evidence. And criminal prosecution only becomes likely when there are more than unsubstantiated allegations. And in justifying that conclusion, the judge drew a distinction between civil claims on the one hand and criminal proceedings on the other hand. In the former case, there's no limit upon the bringing of civil claims, subject to cost sanctions and possible striking out. By contrast, said the judge, with the latter, that is, with criminal proceedings, there's an evidential threshold which has to be crossed before proceedings become a reasonable likelihood. On the facts, the court found that there was not at the relevant time a real likelihood of a criminal prosecution. And I think that approach too could be transposed to other regulatory regimes. Again, financial services being the most obvious. Even though an FCA investigation may result in a criminal prosecution, applying the reasoning from ENRC, documents generated by a bank to prepare for an FCA investigation will not necessarily be privileged because there may be no reasonable likelihood of a criminal prosecution. As I mentioned before, ENRC is now on appeal to the Court of Appeal, but for the time being, the decision certainly narrows the application of litigation privilege, in relation to criminal proceedings at least, by reason of the approach to when criminal proceedings are sufficiently in prospect. And I think in those circumstances, it would be prudent for companies and banks anticipating potential adversarial litigation to make a contemporaneous record of that anticipation in order to set up a later claim for litigation privilege.
Can we run the highlight show from here on?
Highlight show from here on. Iniquity principle, aka the crime fraud exception. It's well established that advice sought or given for the purposes of affecting iniquity, even if that advice is given by a lawyer, is not privileged. Historically, it was an exception which only applied to crime or fraud and not to other types of iniquity. It's been gradually extended over the years. There's a very helpful synthesis of the law and where it's got to in the BBGP and Babcock case. It doesn't apply to all civil wrongs. There are some civil wrongs which don't count as iniquity, but it does apply to others. So where do you draw the line, one may well ask. And in particular, I ask, where does one draw the line in the employment context? Are unlawful team moves iniquity for the purposes of the doctrine? Could discrimination or victimization be iniquity for the purposes of the doctrine? On the first question, there are authorities going both ways. There's the old case of Crescent Farm and Sterling, in which it was held that the torts of interference with contract conspiracy were not necessarily covered by the iniquity principle. By contrast, we've got two decisions going the other way, Gamelin Chemical and Walsh Automation. Both of those were cases about disloyal employees setting up new businesses in competition with their employer and diverting custom in the direction of a new business. And in both of those cases, it was held that legal advice assisting in the setting up of those new businesses was covered by the iniquity principle and therefore disclosable. So documents about ownership of a new business, incorporation of a new business, etc., fell outside the protection of legal advice privilege and were disclosable. I think really what those cases show is that you can't really draw clear lines in this area, unfortunately, and you've got to look at cases on a case-by-case basis in order to see how serious the wrongdoing is and try to come to some conclusion as to whether that wrongdoing amounts to iniquity. And then just one final comment by way of sign-off. I refer you to an imminent decision of the EAT in a case which I argued recently. It concerns the issue of whether advice from a lawyer on how to commit victimisation or discrimination against an employee is sufficiently iniquitous, with the result that it's not privileged. In that case, a copy of the advice in question had been provided anonymously to my client, the employee, who was claiming victimisation and discrimination. Since the allegedly privileged material was discussed at the EAT hearing, the hearing was held in private, so as not to defeat the purpose of the privilege being claimed. And as the hearing was private, I can't give you the names of the parties or the factual details of the case, but there's no confidentiality in the broad legal points that were being argued. In short, my client's case was that the advice from a lawyer allegedly on how to commit relatively serious victimisation and discrimination was advice on how to affect iniquity, and that it was therefore not privileged and could be admitted in evidence at trial. And by contrast, the employer sought to restrict the scope of the iniquity principle, arguing that its extension beyond crime and fraud should be tightly confined. and that discrimination and victimisation aren't sufficiently serious to count as iniquity. The judge indicated that even though the hearing was in private, there is going to be a public judgment. If the claim for privilege is upheld, which of course it won't be, then there'll be a confidential annex to the judgment. But watch this space. There should be a judgment on that question soon. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more details, please visit 11kbw.com.